Welcome everybody to today's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion podcast, where we grapple with current research and historical knowledge to help you get the best out of your pregnancy, birth, and postpartum journey. My name is Dr. Melanie Jackson at Melanie the Midwife. I'm a clinical and research midwife with my PhD, which is why I send out a weekly email which contains the resources that we use to create every single Great Birth Rebellion episode. You can join the podcast mailing list at melaniethemidwife.com. Our Great Birth Rebellion premium members also get access to podcast transcripts, additional resources, the Ask Mel a Question button, and an exclusive monthly Ask Me Anything episode where I answer listener questions. That said, let's get into it. In the interest of keeping this podcast free to you, the listener, I would like to thank our sponsor, the Born at Home documentary film. I've seen this film twice, and both times I was reminded of the joy and bliss that birth can bring. The film follows families as they plan their home births, and we get to witness the birth of their babies. And my favorite part, we get to witness the moments after when women realize that they've done it. And what stands out in this film is that birth has the power to be joyful and healing, and that women and midwives are capable of managing birth together at home most of the time. There are lots of ways to experience a joyful birth, and giving birth at home is one of them. To watch the film, head to the Demand Films website, that's au.demand.film, and search for a screening near you. If you can't find one close by to you, you can actually request a screening through the website for yourself and your local community at no cost by simply clicking on the Request a Screening button. Cinema screenings will continue through this year, 2024, and then the documentary will be available for online streaming in early 2025. So check out the Born at Home website, bornathomefilm.com.au, for more information. The team have also generously provided a discount code for podcast listeners. So enter the code REBEL10, REBEL10, at the cart to claim your discount. All the details are in the show notes, and I would encourage everyone to get along and see this film, Born at Home. Welcome everybody to today's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. And today we are kicking off what I'm calling the Wise Woman series. I'm scouring the universe for experienced, wise midwives who are willing to transfer their knowledge, because historically, knowledge was passed down through stories and oral traditions, and midwives would mentor each other and they'd all learn from each other. And these days, we go to university and we read textbooks and we're taught through policies and the culture of the hospital, but that doesn't really teach us a lot about birth itself. And so the idea of these sessions is to speak to wise midwives who've been around long enough to have seen a massive variety of births and to learn things that you probably will never learn anywhere else except through experience. So today we are tapping into the knowledge of Cheryl Sidery, who is a midwife here in Sydney, Australia, and I'm going to give her a chance to introduce herself. But I met Cheryl because she was a private midwife. And when I was a baby private midwife, everybody used to talk about Cheryl Sidery as kind of one of the wise women. She's rolling her eyes at me. One of the old bags, the experienced midwives who knew the things. And one of your claims to fame too, because we've had Hannah Darlin on the podcast before, but you were her midwife as well, right?
With all four babies.
All four babies. So this is how long Cheryl's been a midwife. She's been midwife to Hannah Darlin four times.
Yeah.
Yeah, Shay and Cheryl.
Yeah. We were Shay and Cheryl for a long time. Cheryl.
Cheryl. Is that what they used to call you? So for those not in the know, Shay and Cheryl were work wives. They were the original work wives. Cheryl, welcome. Welcome to the Great Birth Rebellion podcast.
Thank you, Mel.
All right. I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself because I've made an absolute dog's breakfast of it.
No, you haven't at all.
So So kick us off. What's your career been and where are you now?
So I had my first two children when I was 22 and 24. And I can still, and I was a registered nurse then. So back in the old days, you couldn't do midwifery at university. You had to be a nurse first. And I have told this story before, but when I had my first baby, you know, I didn't see a midwife through my pregnancy, just went to the local GP, and then I came into hospital and had him. And I honestly thought that the women that were looking after me were nurses. They actually were obstetric nurses, but that's, again, another story. But I can really remember this feeling of feeling like I was this superhuman creature who'd grown this baby and now was making milk out of my breast that was keeping him alive, and that the people that were caring for me didn't reflect that back to me. And I wanted to become that person to tell women, you know, you are incredible that you can do this, even though it's like the most commonplace thing in the world. So as soon as my firstborn was at school and Leah was at kindy, you know, went off back to the same hospital and did my training there. So that would have been 1984 to 1985.
I was born in 1984. So you've been a midwife for as long as I've been alive.
That's pretty weird when you think about it, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh. So probably the first 9 months of my training, I was the person crying in the back of the room. And most of the people in the room thought I was crying because I was happy, but I was absolutely horrified, to be honest. I had no idea that this is how women were treated. And I didn't know anything about feminism. I grew up in a patriarchal household. I just walked around full of rage and didn't know what to do with it and didn't know why women were just saying thank you at the end of it. It just, because back then the caesar rate was quite low, but the forceps rate was very high. So high forceps, mid forceps. Women, everyone just had forceps. They didn't push their baby out. They just, and of course everyone was lying on their back. It was just so horrific. And then right at the end of my midwifery training, when I was thinking, well, that's a year of my life I'll never get back. And what will I do now that I've finished? Because I can't be complicit in this. I didn't know what to do with that amount of anger. Or sort of more horror, really. I met Shaker Police in that last 8 weeks of my training, and it was like I can still remember being on an afternoon shift and she was caring for this woman in a way that I had not seen in the 10 months prior. The woman was off the bed. It makes me cry just thinking about it, and that was the beginning of my life. So that was like, okay, who are you? What are you doing? Where have you been all my life? And I followed her around like for the next, you know, how many years did we work together, 20 years or something. Yeah, it was whatever she was doing I had never, ever seen, and it completely blew my mind, and the rest is history. Yeah.
So was she a midwife when you were training to be a midwife?
Shay had completed her midwifery at a different hospital and then had gone and worked with Maggie Leckie-Thompson for I can't remember how long, did an apprenticeship, which is what we did back then, but wanted to work in hospital because she never had as a registered midwife, just to, you know, get that under her belt as well, I think, before launching her own private practice. So, look, to be honest, when I was thinking about talking to you today, in a way, whilst it was the most wonderful thing in the world to actually watch physiological birth, it kind of ruined my whole career. Because if you don't know that, you just go along happily and plug women in and become an obstetric nurse and you go home at the end of the day with no rage. Whereas I just can't be complicit in that. And it's still incredibly frustrating, you know, to know what women are experiencing and feeling so powerless. So you sort of have to work in a micro way. Right, because I don't know how to fix the macro other than, you know, what I've done recently in the last, you know, 5 years ago working at a big teaching hospital setting up publicly funded home birth. That was kind of a conscious decision to make a change from the inside, because when you work outside the system, you're just doing your thing. You're loving the women. You're doing the work. You're just, you know, you're really sheltered from all the reality of what's happening inside. And, of course, it's not like that for all women, but, you know, that's something I'm really proud of, and you know, I'd like to talk about that if there's an opportunity today, because, yeah, you know, that's the learning for midwives, is getting them out.
Getting them out of the hospital?
Yes.
Yes. And so, yeah, I'd love to talk to you about that, because so Cheryl set up a publicly funded home birth program. It's at the Royal Hospital for Women in Randwick, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Cheryl will actually be coming to talk about that as well at the Convergence of Rebellious Midwives conference, which is happening.
Yeah, well, I'll talk about a lot.
Yes, we could talk about it a little bit now, but we're talking about a lot at the conference in August in Sydney. And, you know, there's so much interconnection, Cheryl. So I was born, and while I was being born, you were training to be a midwife, but Shay Caplice had come before you just a little, and then opened your mind up to the possibility that birth didn't have to be the way that you were seeing it in hospital.
That's right. And then so I went and did my apprenticeship with Maggie Leckie Thompson. That would have been 1987, yeah, because Abby was a baby. My daughter Abby, who's now a midwife, came with me because she was breastfeeding. It through to 1988, and then by then I'd met Jane Hardwick Collins. Mm-hmm. And the three of us joined the first group practice of its time back then, yeah.
A private group practice?
A private group practice, yeah.
And you were doing home birth at that?
We were called the group midwifery practice, which is sort of not MGP, but, yeah, we were the first. It was the group midwifery practice, and we worked in the Northern Beaches, and, yeah, we attended lots of births together. I think as we all had small children, and we're trying to kind of work out how we could work together in a different way where the on-call thing wasn't so full on. Mm-hmm. Then after a few years, Jane moved down the South Coast, and then Shay and I continued for many, many years. But in that time, I also worked at the Royal in a whole lot of different roles. I guess I always had this kind of, I don't know, moral dilemma that offering private midwifery is an expensive option, and that women who chose to birth in hospital, you know, needed access to good midwifery care also. So back then, the freestanding birth centre was at Paddington. We all worked there. So for me, Shay uses this lovely term called the cradle of learning, and I learnt a lot working in the birth centre. I mean, it's kind of the same as a home birth, really. It's just women have to drive there. You know, we're very much doing our own thing. I worked there for many, many, many years. Yeah, and even when it moved to Randwick, we all still worked at the birth centre. And Shay and I worked together, continuing our private practice, but we never, ever saw each other at work because one of us always had to be available to our private clients. So we never, ever saw each other. And I had my third child then, and she had her first. And so our kids went to school together, and, you know, we also had visiting rights at the women's at the birth centre. And we had visiting rights at RPA for more complex pregnancies. And some women wanted to birth in the birth centre for, you know, whatever their reason was. And it was, you know, it was fantastic. There was not all this, I don't know, regulation, as much regulation back then. We had a really high normal birth rate, yeah.
So you were pioneers because back then you would have not had any professional indemnity insurance, I imagine.
Back then we actually did. It was through a Gold Coast company. We did have insurance, yeah.
So we're going backwards because we don't have it anymore. We've only got it for antenatal, postnatal.
That's right. And prior to that, I think one of the reasons the insurance was dropped is because there was a couple of claims that were very expensive, and then I think they kind of reviewed it thinking, because prior to that, no, there hadn't been any claims. This is my understanding. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And so they just stopped it. And with that, we lost our visiting rights because we no longer had insurance. Yeah.
So then how long did you work in that capacity? Because you've been a midwife nearly 40 years. And had you worked clinically that whole time?
Yeah, that whole time. So after working at the birth centre for a long time, then by then I had another child, so I'd had four kids by then, and I needed to work Monday to Friday. So I went and did another degree and learnt all about perinatal mental health. And I did that job for about 8 years and loved it. Yeah, it was a fabulous job. Actually really enhanced my midwifery with my private clients because I learnt all about attachment, which is such a thing now. Everyone talks about it. Who doesn't know the holistic psychologist? Everybody. But back then it was kind of, I mean, it wasn't new, but it wasn't something that there was no such thing as perinatal mental health.
Yeah.
We as private midwives always address the woman's emotional well-being. We always talked about her experience of being mothered and, you know, what support she has. We just naturally delved into those conversations. But back then in the public system, and I guess, you know, private obstetrics, we didn't ask, women were never asked that question. It was all about their physical being, you know, their blood tests and their, you know, the measurements of their baby. So that would have been the year 2000 or something, when perinatal mental health became, you know, part of your antenatal and postnatal care of women. So, you know, I learned a lot in that job. And then we set up MGP at the Royal. So I was part of that. And then once my fourth baby was old enough for me to go back into full-time private practice. So prior to that, when I was at the Royal, I kept doing home births, but not like 40 a year, maybe, you know, 10 or 15, 20 a year. And finally, when all the kids had grown up, it was like, right, now I just want to do that full-time. So by then we'd got endorsement, and I probably did that for, well, until February last year was my last home birth. Yeah.
So you've seen it, you really have seen it all, right from back in the days where everyone was getting episiotomies and forceps. And I imagine before epidurals, because epidurals aren't that old.
Epidurals had started then, yes.
Right, yeah. Right. Ooh. And so your mentors were Shay, but also Maggie Leckie Thompson, which, yes. Fun fact, my mentor was Robin Dempsey and Hannah Darlin. And Robin Dempsey's midwife was Maggie.
And that's so right.
Yes, right. There's
Maggie was Jane's midwife as well, and Shay, yes, was Jane's midwife, and then Shay was my midwife, and I was Jane's midwife. Oh, we're all midwives to each other.
Yes. It's just the proper community.
Yeah, very much was, yeah.
Yes. And so what I really want to tap your brain for today is exploring physiological birth, because, you know, you experienced it yourself and didn't realize that that's not what the majority of women are experiencing or the majority of midwives are seeing. So for midwives who are trying to support and facilitate physiological birth in their work, what do you think they should or should not be doing in the birth space if the aim is to encourage and support physiological birth?
Well, when I'm working with, you know, newer midwives, I mean, it might even sound a bit corny, but I feel like the environment needs to be the same as lovemaking. So the fact that the same hormones, so can you hear the kids running down the lane, coming home from school running down the lane?
It's beautiful.
In order to create the right environment for giving birth, it needs to be the same as for women making love. So, you know, low lights, plus or minus soft music, no one's talking, no one's, you know, coming in and out of the door. It's just, it's no wonder that it doesn't work that well in hospital, except if the women arrive like really close to giving birth. It's a miracle it works at all. I guess the reason it probably does is that when women are, you know, in their adult life and they're looking at contemporary imagery of women giving birth in the media, mostly it's in a bright room with people yelling and people rescuing her and, you know, the partner acting like a bumbling idiot running around. You know, that's every film you've ever seen. around birth is like that. So it's not surprising that women think that that's how it is. You know, it's so rare that you've ever watched a woman giving birth in a film where you just go, yep, that's very similar to how it is. It's never like that. And it's interesting because I was actually talking about this to someone the other day. You know, when you're at those births and the baby is just not coming and you've tried everything, it's just not coming. And out of desperation, you go, well, there's only one thing left, and that's to lie her on her back and put her knees up, and it bloody comes out. And you're just like flabbergasted. It's like, why would it come out in the most non-physiological way? And I just wonder whether it's because women expect to be in that position. Because sometimes it comes out like that. You've tried that, you know, with the gung-ho pushing, you've tried everything, yeah, and finally you do that and it comes out. But anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the environment is important. Yeah, it's just like not talking.
Not
tapping on a computer.
Yes.
Tappity tap, so, tap, tap, tap. It is in hospital now.
And when you arrive to a home birth, what's your entry? Like, I mean, I know what I do, and I talk to my clients about, okay, when I get there, just leave the door unlocked because I'm going to help myself in and I'm going to quietly bring my bags in and I'm not going to really say hello. I'm, you know, just kind of really try and sink into the scene and be out of the way.
That's exactly what we all do, yeah.
Right, okay, so this is what Sherry does.
I learned many years ago to make sure they leave the front door open because they didn't, and I was at the door and they couldn't hear me and I heard the baby coming out. So, okay, no, self, don't ever do that again. Make sure you leave the door open. Invisible. And I kind of check myself when I'm driving there. You know, I'll do kind of check in my body, like, am I feeling anything negative or am I worried about anything? No, I'm not. And you don't want her to be relying on you for anything. Like, everything she needs is within herself. And I mean, I suppose for the last, 50 years or 40 years, partners have been involved in birth. And, you know, sometimes it's not perfect. Some of the most beautiful births I've been to have just been with women. And that's not a criticism of men because, interestingly, I wonder whether you agree with this. I actually can't think of any home birth that I've ever been to where the partner was a douchebag. Whereas I've experienced lots in hospital, you know, complaining about being tired or wanting to turn the TV on or I'm hungry or it's like all about their needs. Like, yes. You just maybe not feel like it's all about you for a minute. But I don't think I've ever seen that. Well, no, actually, that's not true. Once. And it was more appropriate that he just wasn't there. So I put him to bed.
Yeah, I've had a few of those circumstances, but interestingly. No, but and it's actually been preempted that was going to happen. So either the woman said, look, my husband's not really cut out for this situation, so the plan is for him to be over there or to him. He's actually just going to stay away and I've got his doula coming. The times where it's happened, the couple has identified that he's not the best person to be in the space and they've both agreed that they're going to have a different support person, which is insightful, I think, and just,
absolutely.
You know, yeah.
But I wonder whether it's because the kind of women who choose to birth at home also are partnered with, you know, pretty awesome men.
Yeah.
That's just that's a very broad statement, but you know what I mean. Yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah,
rare.
A bit of an anecdote.
Yeah.
And I think too, one of the things that allows us to enter a birth space like that is that we've spent half a year with these women already, and we know exactly what they're expecting of us, and we know what they know already, and we know we don't have to say anything. But I imagine that for women. It's all been said through the care. Mm. And one of the issues with how the hospital is at the moment, most women have got fragmented care. And so when the midwife arrives, if she doesn't say anything, she doesn't know if this woman is expecting an epidural or expecting a water birth or how she feels about anything unless there's been a birth plan presented to them. It's really challenging to enter a birth space like that and just not say anything. And Some women might appreciate that. Other women might say, like, the midwife didn't even talk to me. You know, so it's such a unique circumstance to be able to enter a birth space quietly and unobtrusively, because we don't need to ask any questions. Yeah.
And having worked in the hospital, you know, some midwives who are providing fragmented care actually understand that and do that well, and a lot don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. And I think, and I have seen midwives do this really well. I've seen there's a particular midwife, she asked one single question, which I thought was perfect. She walked in, it was for me when I was transferring a client in, all she said was, "What can I do for you today?" And that opened up the opportunity for the woman to tell her exactly what her expectations were. So I think that's a really nice line for midwives. If you sort of think, I want to walk into this room unobtrusively, just ask the woman, "What can I do for you today?"
Yeah. If she's able to communicate those needs.
Correct.
What those things are. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you've come into the birth space. What do you do next?
I always get all my stuff out, you know, quietly and sort of not inside the birth space, but somewhere over there, because, you know, I don't want to get caught out if it just suddenly all happens. So to me, that's really important. And that's how I taught the midwives who were doing home births at the women's, you know, you've got to get all your stuff out. Like, we used to deliver it to the house, all the stuff before the birth, which is different in private practice. You know, you're carting it out from the boot. But, you know, having all your stuff out so you know where everything is, so you're not caught short. Yeah, that's probably the next thing I do. And, I also like check in all the time with my body. Like, you know, it's sometimes mostly you're at a birth and you feel very calm and relaxed, but occasionally you don't. And it's just like, what is going on? You know, and sometimes I'm wrong. You know, I think, well, I'm feeling anxious, but I don't know why. And then the baby comes out and it's all fine. But sometimes you get that kind of not quite sure feeling and things aren't great. But that, I mean, that's sort of unusual too. But yeah, I love that feeling of just being totally relaxed, but at the same time, all of my senses are attuned. So I'm listening. I think I even use my olfactory, you know, my sense of smell. There's a lot going on, but no one would know. Like, women will always say afterwards, you know, I felt like I was dying, and I'd open my eye and think, God, she looks so relaxed. Everything must be fine. Which I think that just comes from being, you know, from doing it for a long time.
Yeah, there's a talent to mentally, I do think we're mentally busy as midwives, but the skill is to present a calm.
Yeah, you're outwardly calm. Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, what you were saying about tapping into how you were feeling as a midwife and checking in with your body, I think midwives who've been with birth for a long time actually start to rely on their own instinct and expertise a lot more than tick box midwifery.
Yes, yeah.
And so I think, yeah, it's possible that you're subconsciously also honouring the fact that you have an instinctual knowledge that's built up over time.
Yeah, I think it's definitely instinctual. There's sometimes I think, like, I've never been to a birth where I, you know, where the woman's declined having the baby listened to. And even though, you know, you do it as a, it's kind of, again, you just listen to the baby because that's what we're there for, in a way, provide holding space and checking that everything's fine. And the fetal hearts are always fine. Yeah. But I don't even know that I feel reassured by that, because I just know that they're fine. Yeah. And I often wonder, like, what would it be like if we didn't have to do that at all? You just actually just could be there. But yes. Anyway, like,
yeah,
like, we can't not do that, because otherwise they'd be free birthing.
Well, yeah, and I mean, we do check, and I agree with you, so rarely. I think there's one time, maybe two times, where we transferred simply because the heart rate was weird, but both times the baby was fine.
Yeah, once I've had that too. Yeah, it was really, really high. It was like around 200 for a few hours, and I thought that's not normal. You know,
was the baby born okay?
Yeah, the baby was born fine. Yeah.
Yeah, that was our experience too. Is both times that we transferred for fetal heart, the baby was okay.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're going to listen, you can't ignore what the result is.
No. No, that's right.
You know, I waited, so gave her something sweet, gave her more to drink. I thought maybe she's too hot, got her out of the pool, did all the things, and it was still high. But that's the only one I can remember off the top of my head. Can you hear that drilling? Is that?
A little bit, but it's not. It's not obtrusive. Yeah.
Okay.
And so for people who are listening who have never truly experienced an uninterrupted or physiological birth, can you describe it? What happened?
I think most women behave the same. So they're not talking either. So sometimes when you go to a woman who's given birth before and you get there and you think, oh, she's called a bit early, but then you actually are there while the whole thing unfolds. Like once I remember this beautiful woman and I went to do a routine antenatal visit, and while I was there, she went into labor. It was so weird. Like that's never happened before. Yeah, we were chatting and then she goes, and it all just kind of unfolded. So, women become, less outward. They're less engaged with you. A lot of women get like a bit bristly with their partner. They either, don't want you to leave at all, or they actually go right away and don't want you anywhere near them. That's kind of one extreme or the other. And I've had a few women over the years where I've arrived and they've sort of been in a cupboard almost, like that's how much they didn't want you to go near them. Got that message, okay, that's fine. And as the labor progresses and as they open up more, they definitely become less and less and less outward, more inward. I like it when you see that little bead of sweat on their top lip. I know they're getting closer. That lovely little shake of the top of their thighs, it's time to start filling the pool up. But the sounds that women make are just so similar. It's, you just know the more births you go to that you don't need to do internals because everything is familiar. It's like, and I feel it in my body as well. And so I guess over the years I've encouraged women to get into the pool later than earlier because most women have water births these days, like I'd say probably 85% or something. And the women that don't, it's either because it wasn't ready or it was their first baby and the baby wasn't coming, so you got them out. But, it's just like this beautiful dance that they do, isn't it? And they start out upright, and then as the birth's getting closer, they get lower to the ground. If they're not birthing in the pool, women will usually drop to their knees right around the time that the waters will release, and then you hear that beautiful sound. You know that the baby's coming. Yeah. I don't know, become very hands-off over the years, not really, just do less and less and less the more births that I attended over the years. I don't know, it must be thousands now. It'd be a lot, yeah. Again, that feeling of knowing in your body that she's getting closer, it's adrenaline but without feeling nervous. It's more kind of excitement.
Yeah.
So, and that's the other thing I've noticed. I then move, if she's in the pool, I'll be away from the pool. And as second stage is approaching, I will move closer. I'll usually sit behind her, but she knows that I'm there, but I'm not kind of in her face. And that's, I'll find that interesting too. Some women will stay with their back to you on all fours, and other women will intentionally turn around because they want to look at you. And that's just something that happens. That's part of the dance, isn't it? You don't orchestrate that. It just happens. I guess that's how it, it's like a dance, isn't it? Yeah.
Some women do
that whole dance with their partner, and some women really want to dance alone.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself talking to the women if, you know, as things are unfolding? So sometimes, I don't know if everybody does this, but, you know, something changes.
As it's getting closer, just that little point, this is just perfect. You're doing beautifully. Yeah. Just little, really short little, you know, statements of, in a soft voice of, I mean, sometimes the vibe might be like a bit jokey. People are telling, like Shay used to quietly sing. Actually, it used to annoy me, but when I think about it now, I find it sort of quite endearing. She'd go, "Well, she'll be coming down the vagina when she comes, yeehaw!" But really soft. Like when I think about it now, it's so silly. But the women would laugh. It's just, you know, when the pinching happened. And like when women have given birth before, I guess they need less of that. When women haven't birthed before, they do need more little kind of, everything's perfect. This is great. Like you're doing fine. Particularly when they're birthing at home and, you know, you've had that whole conversation about pain relief. You know, if you say to the woman now, if you ask me for pain relief, if everything's progressing normally, we're not going to hospital for pain relief. Is that what you want? And she will 100% that's what I want. And of course, you know, for an hour, she's like, "I just want to go to hospital." And you go like, this is what we talk about. This is exactly why you don't need it, because you're absolutely fine, as opposed to when you've got to have those difficult conversations when things aren't going normally. Well, actually, what needs to happen is you probably need to go to hospital and have an epidural, because sometimes it works.
And I've had those conversations with women before. They're like, "I think I want to go to hospital for an epidural." And they're in the pool. You can hear that it's just transition talk, right? It's just transition talk. And I'll say to them, "I think you're in transition and that you're hitting the hardest part of your labor and that your baby's going to be born soon. So if you would like an epidural, you need to get out of the pool and get dressed, and we need to get in the car. And we've got to drive to the hospital. And when we get to the hospital, you're going to have to walk to the front desk and give them your name and do all that stuff. And then they'll take you to your room and introduce you to your new midwife. And then they'll ask you all these questions. They'll want to do a vaginal exam. And then they'll send in the anaesthetist. And do you know what I think is going to happen before you get your epidural? I think you're going to have your baby."
That's right.
Right. And they're going, "Oh, right, it sounds all too hard. I'll just stay here." Like, yeah, let's do that.
That's so good. So, then you have those lovely conversations the next day that, "Remember when I kept asking for pain relief and I didn't really want it?"
And they say, thanks.
Sometimes I'll leave the room if they're hounding on about it, or what, you know, say if they're not in the pool, I'll get them in, or if they've been in the pool for a long time and they're really upset, I will actually get them out and put them in the shower and say, "You just need some time out." Like, you know, Rhea Dempsey calls it the crisis of confidence. Yeah. And sometimes women, I find they do that better alone. Sometimes the sympathetic, loving environment is actually making it worse.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, put women into the shower and then you hear, like, after half an hour, it's like, and you've waited for hours for that to happen. And then, you know, they're ready to have a baby. Okay, come back in, we've warmed the pool up, get back in, and they give birth. You know, they, in that time alone in there, it's like they've really dug deep. You know, particularly when they're looking at your partner, "You're not listening. I don't want to be here. I have to go. Take me. You're not listening." And he's like looking at you and looking at her, and he wants so much to fix it, you know, because he's a good man, and, you know, what, she's going to kill me if I don't. And it's like, I say, you go and make something to eat, and I'm going to put her in the shower. And she's cranky with you, because that's not what she wants. And then they just, you know, they do that last bit of opening up, and then the baby comes and they're so happy afterwards.
Yes. Well, and I think it's a difference between trying to rescue women from the process of birth and actually support them through the process of birth.
Totally. That's exactly what it is.
I think if you think, right, I can rescue this woman from this process, you're actually in the long run not helping them. So it's a little bit of, I don't want to say tough love, but it's like, you know, because you've nurtured lots and lots of women through labor, and you know that this is a pretty normal part of labor where every woman at some point, they want to tap out and they think, "I don't want to do this anymore. And the,
you told them that they will feel like this in labor, that, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to ask to go to hospital, you're going to feel like you can't do it for another minute, and that is a good sign. It means you're getting close, and you're going to be really upset with me because I'm going to say no, and that's what's going to happen. So they forget all that, you know, because they're it's lovely when it does work, and then they're just so stoked the next day.
Yes. Yeah. And when the baby's emerging, so, you know, we know that the sounds change all of a sudden. You know, for me, I crochet at a birth. That's my birth demeanor, is the quiet crocheting midwife in the back corner, and all the things are going on in my head and I'm just crocheting away. And then there's a moment where I put my crocheting down and I don't put it on the couch. I put it back in the bag and it gets put away because I heard that sound that means it's time to get your torch and your mirror out and see what's going on, and you're not going to be able to sit in the corner anymore. It's time to, move closer to the pool, like you said.
You move closer, don't you? Yeah, you just naturally come in,
Yeah, and so women get to that point and then they start pushing. So what do you do to support them through that process of the baby emerging?
I think there's a bit more talking then, isn't there?
Potentially.
One thing I say to women during their pregnancy too is that the only difference between us as a mammal that gives birth and breastfeeds and every other mammal on the planet is the development of our neocortex. I said, so if you think about when if you're a golden Labrador, she's not going to say to her owner, can you take me to hospital for pepidine or what's it called now, morphine? Like, it's because she doesn't have the ability to have that conversation with herself. And I said, and that's the only difference between you and every other mammal that gives birth, is that you have a neocortex that says to you, I can't do this. This is ridiculous. It's all too hard. So you have to switch off. You can listen to that and go, oh, that's my, you know, whatever part of my brain, my neocortex, that's telling me it's too hard. And so you have to just not listen to it and switch off. So, you know, sometimes I'll say to them, that's your neocortex. Yeah, okay. You know, and then they'll go back into it. But during second stage, I guess, you're a bit more, you're listening a bit more often to baby and, not nervous adrenaline, but there's a bit of adrenaline happening because you know the baby's going to come soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find at this point, I personally kind of relay to the woman things that I'm seeing too. You know, so there's a bit of relaying of information from the woman and also from the midwife. And I think, obviously, I know the answer to this, but for people listening, at home, we don't really coach the women through pushing.
No.
So if you're in hospital, they say, right, you're getting a contraction now. It's time to do the pushes, and they might give you some instructions. But at home, we kind of let them we just watch it unfold. This is a big loaded question, but what would be the signs that you need to intervene in that process?
I guess occasionally with women having their first baby, you know, like they do seem to be using up a lot of effort and energy in pushing that's actually not helpful. You know, lots of breath holding and pushing up into their face and, you know, the veins in their forehead. It's like you kind of hope that they will get it together and then they don't. So, you know, you might have that conversation then. You know, maybe pop your hand there and see when you're pushing like that, do you feel anything move? Just little conversations like that. And I suppose over the years, you know, as I suppose there's been, you know, more, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Since we became indoors and there's a lot more regulation and difficulties for many midwives on if they do need to go to hospital, I think it changed all of our practices a bit in that, you know, no longer back in the old days, we'd let women, not let, but sometimes would take 6 hours to push the baby out. And if the fetal hearts are fine, you just waited that long. Whereas there is no way in the world you could do that now. You'd either have to change all of your notes, like you just wouldn't do it. Because if you went to hospital, you'd get crucified. So, and, you know, I've had these conversations with colleagues. It's like you just, I would, you know, back in the old days, well, you know, even though the baby is a deep transverse arrest, if you can move it down more, it's going to be a forceps as opposed to a cesarean.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, hopefully the baby will turn, or if it's a deflexed OP, but it'll be a seizure if we go now. So let's just, you know, give it a red hot go and see if it will rotate. But these days, you know, I felt like we just can't do that because, you know, there's so many midwives get, you know, reported. Yeah.
Can we talk about posterior? Because this is something that you would learn over time. Because posterior babies happen at home, I don't know why, but for some reason more so the last 5 years, I feel like, than any other time. As a baby midwife, I just never recall having to deal with posterior labours as much as we do now. I don't know what it's about. But
you think it's because your caseload's bigger or?
Maybe. I can't put my finger on it. Maybe what I think is over time I've been willing to take on women with more colourful histories, like obstetric history, and potentially early on.
What's your ratio between primips and multips? Because with a multip, you just notice, oh, it came out face to pubes. You know, the face is looking up.
Yeah.
You know, that she'll be pushing. You think, wow, that's her third baby. I'm thinking to myself, she's pushing really hard. It's probably going to be back to front and it'll come out back to front. And you go, you know, what a legend. But with first babies, you know, if your caseload's half and half, then you will see them probably once every couple of years.
Yeah. Have you got clever strategies for posterior babies?
I mean, I've tried doing internal manoeuvres to try and rotate the head and it's never worked. I mean, even my own first grandchild in the home birth was a really long second stage and I could move the head a little bit to try and flex it and move it around and she would just always spin back. So,
like manual rotation, you tried
manual rotation. She just would not stay there, which doesn't suit her personality. She's the most chilled, beautiful fairy in the world. Yeah, she's just doing this, you know.
Yes.
I mean, that's about all you can do. I suppose that I haven't really actually had that many persistent OP. They've usually always rotated and come out. But, you know, I've probably tried, like, the sterile water injections. It's usually long and it will often end up in a transfer, you know, which because it's just that women will get to 6 centimetres for hours because the baby won't rotate. And you just know that the caput's getting bigger, you know, the swelling on the top of the head. And you just, the baby's OP. And the strange thing is, those women often do well with an epidural. You give them an epidural, you give them 4 hours sleep, they get a little bit of hormone to get things cracking on, they have a normal birth. And you go, well, would that have happened at home? It's a very interesting question that I've asked myself a million times. Like, we don't know what would have happened because we don't push it for a week. You know, we're not doing it for a week. We just know that that's not okay. So.
Yeah.
I actually looked up the perinatal maternal mortality rate and it's pretty bad in Africa compared to here. And, of course, we don't know what happens because there's not much research about what happens if you leave a woman in labour for a week with a persistent posterior baby that doesn't come out. Do they become septic? You know, it could end up really bad for both mother and baby. In Africa, like, the maternal death rate's still about 1 in 100.
Yeah.
So I remember years ago there was an obstetrician at RPA who told me once he went to the pyramids in Egypt and there was this hieroglyphic sign that said that women in pregnancy were not allowed to enter because it would insult the gods because she was on the cusp of life and death. And this was it really got me thinking, like, what would have the maternal death rate have been until, you know, like probably up until the 1900s, because there's not much evidence about it. We don't know. And if it's 1 in 100 in Africa, and in Australia it's like, what is it, 3 per 100,000, which is pretty good. Yep. But as much as we know that there's way too many interventions, some of them are good.
Well, yeah, my transfer rate's about 10%. Not all of those are emergencies. So in my head, I figure, look, 90% of babies and women probably don't need much more than some basic midwifery care. And then there's a proportion that needs more advanced care, which we're grateful to medicine for, which wouldn't have existed back in the day.
That is about right. The transfer rate should be, I reckon, if you have a 50% multips, 50% primips, it should be about 10 to 15%. That's a very good transfer rate.
Yeah, it's not that everyone's going to have a cesarean, but it's a precaution. Like, you think, oh, that's thick meconium, off we go. And then the baby's born and everyone's really good and you go, okay, well, look, we're transferring just in case. It's actually all fine. But, yeah, so posterior labours, though, they've been, because at home we're already doing everything, right? They're in physiological positioning. They haven't been interrupted. There's no Cinto to kind of wedge the baby down in there. And so then it's just about waiting. And I've noticed with posterior babies, their heart rates can do some funny things while they rotate.
Yeah.
Which I think bothers people at hospitals sometimes, and they go, oh, my gosh, the baby's distressed, get it out. But maybe it's just rotating. All right.
Yeah, I feel like the persistent posterior babies are less in women who choose to birth at home, and my understanding is because they're physically very active. But then my daughter was, and she was LOA for the whole pregnancy, when you could tell which position she was in, until the day she went into labor. And then she called me and said, the baby's did this massive flip onto the other side. It's the first time she's been over there. And then she went into labor. It's like, no.
Did she stay home? Did she have the baby at home?
We ended up going to hospital after about 26 hours or something. And Andrew was there and he did a lovely vacuum. Yeah, yes. He uses the vacuum to keep the baby in the right position. It's very clever. Yeah, he's clever.
I've seen that before as well. And I've seen some of the most expert manual rotations in my time.
And you need, like, long, big hands, which we don't have.
Or I really think, long fingers. And we're just not. I think there's a knowledge that you have to have about how much pressure you can put on when and what feels like. Yeah, I mean, it's a skill, manual rotation.
They're using the benefit of ultrasound to 100% know where the back of the head is.
Yes.
Which we're using sutures and fontanelles, and sometimes you're wrong.
Yes.
You know, you're pretty sure, and then it comes out the other way and you go, oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
So can you think of something that you've learnt from birth that you could only have learnt because you're sitting down and watching physiological birth?
Oh. It's impossible to know, because most of the births I've been to have been physiological. They're either in a birth centre or at home.
Yes.
So I don't know what the opposite is. In fact, it's only been – I've never actually worked – in delivery suite, or what do you call it, birth suite.
Yes.
I did a few times when I was in MGP, and now that I'm working remotely, I've been doing it a bit lately.
Yeah.
Very weird.
I think you're right. It's a completely different skill set, because people ask me, oh, why don't you have visiting rights at hospital? And I said, it's like saying to a hospital midwife, just why don't you go and do births at home? It's a completely different skill set.
Totally different, yeah.
And they know stuff that I don't know, and I know a lot of stuff that they don't know, only because I've been watching physiological birth for 16 years.
Well, the only thing we don't know about working in a hospital is how to put all that stuff onto a computer, because that's all they're doing. It was a weird feeling a couple of weeks ago when I was working out there, where it was I was initially so clunky and had absolutely no idea, and it was annoying me the whole time. I was like, this is such a waste of my time. And I started to get a bit better at it, and I thought, oh, I'm feeling a little bit clever about this. And I went, that is not a skill that you need to be proud of, being good at the computer.
Data entry. Very good at data entry.
Oh, everything's on the computer. It's so bad. Yeah.
All right. Can we talk placentas? Placental birth. Oh, wait. I want to ask one other question first. Well, two questions. What's your favorite part of the birth process? What part do you get to? You're like, oh, I love this part.
Do you know what it is? It's the next morning. Oh. I love coming to her house the next morning and she's sitting up in bed because I've told her she can't get up. And she's got breakfast. I really will always try to go in the morning if I can, unless you've been there all night. I just love that feeling when you just look into her eyes and she's just like, she just feels like an absolute legend. And you've shared that magic when you were last together. I know that I love that. And I guess I also love when everything's done and they're in bed and the baby's on the breast and you've given her something to eat and then you've packed up and you're ready to leave. You know, being there for a few hours and it's time to go and, you know, you give her a hug and you just, I mean, they're kind of similar, but I just love that feeling so much.
Yes.
I've just realized it's because that's why I did midwifery. Isn't it? I said that right at the very beginning. I only just realized that they're actually the same thing. It's just a look in her, you looking at her, and she knows that you think that she's an absolute legend.
Yeah. And you've shared it all together for so long, and they've invited you into that as well.
Yeah, it's such an incredible privilege and never ever to be underestimated. I just love that. We talked before about the thing that you love the most. For me, when I think about, you know, antenatal care, intrapartum care, like birth care, and then postnatal care, I think I love postnatal care. I love watching women become mothers. You know, there's this beautiful word for it now, matriescence, which is a fairly new term which we didn't really know before. You know, it's so much bigger than giving birth. It's so much bigger than pushing a baby out. It's like this selfless giving up of everything you knew about yourself before. I'm becoming a whole new person. And particularly when women have had complex mothering themselves, they have to reinvent themselves. They don't want their mother coming out of their mouth. And so we have this beautiful opportunity to work with women during the pregnancy and in the early postnatal care to guide them through how to become, you know, the best version of themselves as a mother, because it's really hard work for some women. And mothering is just, it's not really acknowledged in our culture. It's like in other cultures, you're like the pinnacle of society once you've had a baby. But in our culture, it's, it's not really acknowledged. It's more how much money you earn and what you do for a job. So I love that part. I love the fact that we have 6 weeks to follow women up. And, of course, we have the privilege then of following them up for all of their babies. Mm-hmm. Last year I looked after a woman whose mother had her at home with me. So her mother had all her children, then one of her children had a baby at home with me. I mean, it doesn't get more magical than that. But watching, and then her mother was at the birth. Like, that is just, there's not many professions that you're able to be part of their lives for that long. So I love that. I love that so much.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've had two particular families who've had all five of their babies with me. And this month I'm about to be a midwife to the daughter of a woman who I cared for her mum, and now she's grown.
So same thing.
Yeah, she's having her baby. And you, like, she watched me work to help her mum have her siblings. Yeah, it's magical.
And all the siblings. It's always weird though, isn't it? Because you never get to know the last born as well as you know all the other kids. Yeah, I love
it. Yes. So, and then the opposite, what is your least favorite part of the birth process?
I don't like women bleeding, but that's not part of the birth.
I don't like that either.
Do you have a least favourite?
Okay.
It's not great when things don't go normally.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? The long prodromal labour that goes on for days and days. Women going past 43 yes. weeks. Don't like that when you're not sleeping. There's a few things that are hard.
So we don't like people going to 43 weeks. I love that that's where your cutoff is. We don't like women going to
43 weeks. Just having those difficult conversations, you know, about when she's – because, see, many years ago I decided that I would not work with women who were home birth. It had to be born – the baby had to be born at home. It's just like, no. And I also decided years ago that I won't – and this, you know, might sound like I'm being, you know, really annoying, but I just won't look after women that won't have blood tests or at least one ultrasound. Even if it's right at the end, like 35 weeks, I want to know that the baby has a normal heart because it's 1 in 100 don't.
Yep.
And I want to know where the placenta is.
Yep.
And I would say to them, you don't have to do any of those things, but you have to go to a different midwife if you absolutely don't want that. And I guess it's that, you know, if they're absolutely hell-bent on not having any blood tests or any of those things, I'm just not the person for them. You know,
yeah.
And there's no judgment. Like, it's fine if they don't want to do that, but I don't want to look after them. Yeah.
But I think that speaks to you knowing your own personal boundaries. And the women, if they know that from the beginning, there's no surprises. It's not like you drop that on them in the at the end exactly. of their pregnancy.
Yeah, that's in like the, that. You know, chatting and meeting each other right before we've even bought. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like women bleeding either. My least favourite part.
Yeah, what's and yours?
I think this is women's too, is, you know, the baby comes out, everything's beautiful, and then, you know, my least favourite part is reminding them that there's a little bit of work left to do for the placenta. I hate having to say to them, hey.
The placenta's work?
I feel like if women – they have the baby, if they completely, if they mentally just go, oh, I've done that, and then they haven't gotten out of the pool, and then there's the house is starting to wake up, and then she sort of thinks, oh, I'll have a lie down for a second, and I'll have a snack, and takes her attention away from the placenta, that maybe it takes longer, and I almost want for them to just kind of have the placenta so they can take a full breath out. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm a bit bossy about that. Like
getting the placenta out?
Yeah, no, there's no talking on the phone or people coming into the room. We're not done yet. Placenta's got to come out. It does. It totally distracts them. Then they don't want to give birth to it later. It's like, yeah, because you have to do it now.
That's my thing. Yeah, well, there is this window where it's kind of the placenta's primed to be born, and if you kind of miss it and then it's an hour and a half later and you're like, ah, now we've got to kind of reinstate the birth space, lights down, everyone out.
I mean, there's going to be lots of midwives who roll their eyes and go, ooh, why does she do that? But, years ago, like, you know, as a newish midwife, you'd sit around for hours waiting for the bloody placenta to come out, only to find that she just didn't have any contractions and no bloody show, like, you know, no gush of blood. And it'd been separated who knows how long and just sitting in the, you know, lower segment or in the posterior vagina wall. It's like, so I don't know. I just will say to the woman during pregnancy, if the placenta's not born in whatever time, like after half an hour, I said, if you will let me, I want to have a feel. And I just, you know, grab the cord and it's 99% of the time it's right there. But she doesn't have the sense of it being there yet because it hasn't plopped through the cervix.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to wait 2 hours to find that out. I want to know that now. And, you know, so, yeah, I'm probably old school bossy and say, you know, sometimes she'll say, no, I don't want you to feel it. So then I go and sit on the toilet, the ice cream bucket in the toilet, and it will just plop out. But if they want to give birth to it in the pool, we're not sitting in the pool for an hour.
Yeah. Well, it does take effort.
The baby can't breastfeed easily, and it's all everyone starts to get cold, and just, yeah.
Yes, and I think that comes from experience, though, as well, going, do you know what? It's not going to come out if we do that. It takes concentration and effort. But my least favorite part is having to remind the woman, like, by the way, there's still something that you need to do, and that is the placenta, and it just means you need to either be upright or on the toilet or just, like, just give it some of your attention. We can't fully
give it your attention.
Yeah.
And reminding them that it actually doesn't hurt. And most women are scared of it until it's half out and they go, oh, that felt really good. And I instantly feel better because I say to them, you are going to feel so good once it's out. It's worth getting it out because you know how uncomfortable you are now? That's going to instantly go away. Well, then brackets, except if you've had a baby before, then you'll have afterbirth pains.
my favorite part is just watching the baby come through the peri and, like, its lips and then out to its chin. And then that might be a more anxiety-provoking part for some midwives because it's kind of like that's the time where if you need to do something for this woman, I feel like that could be the time if it's going to be then.
People don't really do that.
Very rarely. No, it's not nerves.
What's your favourite part?
I don't know. When the head's out. Like anything's
done till the placenta's out. It all just feels one and the same. Yeah. I don't think I've ever had a big shoulder, stuck shoulders at home. In the hospital I have, but never at home. It's interesting, like I have, when I teach those skills, I tell midwives to have a little tiny video ready to press play for all of those different things. So it's always there in your head, not the help mnemonic, because whoever does that, but just knowing, okay, I'm going to do this, 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 and this, and feeling and saying to them, you will always be able to get the baby out. It will never not come out. So you have to fully trust that you're going to be able to get the baby out. And so having that level of confidence stops you from feeling, like, terrified. Yeah. You know, like occasionally, you know, when the face comes out, you go, that's a lot of baby in those cheeks. You know, it's all, like, shoved up against their buttocks and it doesn't restitute. And you wait for the next contraction and there's no movement. And there's just things you do. One of the things I do is I get the partner to kneel next to the pool. And so she stands up and she puts her leg that's close to the outside of the pool onto his bent knee. So he's kneeling and she uses his leg for support and mostly they just rotate and then come out. I don't think I've ever had to physically get someone completely out to do manoeuvres that I can think of unless I've just forgotten.
So that's like what do they call it, that position?
So it's kind of like the running.
Running,
you know, it's kind of like a modified McRoberts, except it's only one leg, and just the movement of her standing and lifting one leg out over the pool and onto his leg will usually the baby will move.
Yes,
because she can't put her leg onto the side of the pool because it's too soft.
Yes, that's your first go-to.
That's what I always do if it hasn't rotated, restituted at all. I don't want to waste that much time, and usually, you know, you'll see. The next contraction will come and rotate and come out.
So that'll create restitution. So baby's out and midwives will recognise it as like the turtle sign where it looks like the baby's trying to go back into the vagina and then the head doesn't restitute. That's your first signal to do that little something. Modified something, yeah. Do something. And then the next contraction comes and your experience has been that the baby will rotate and come with that next contraction.
And if it doesn't, I would get her out of the pool, get her onto all fours, leaning right forward and go in for the posterior arm because you're behind her and there's so much room up behind the sacrum that you can usually always get your arm up in there.
Yes. That's my favourite.
It always works. I wouldn't start with McRoberts lying down. I'd start the other way around. Yeah.
Yeah, and starting with, because that's interesting, because a lot of midwives start with internal manoeuvres now is the, and going in for the posterior arm. That's certainly my strategy is the getting out of the pool, and if the getting out movement doesn't work, going in for the posterior arm, and that's worked every time. I haven't had to progress past that.
You know, you always go in from the sacrum side. I think some midwives, if they are nervous and they've got the woman lying down, you know, even with her legs up, and they try to put their fingers in at the top where the symphysis bone is, they will freak out because there's no room there, because they forget that they've actually got to go in from underneath. So if you start with them on all fours, you're naturally going to go to the top where the chin is and go up to the sacrum, and there's always room to get your hand in there.
Yes.
Yeah. And I like to be honest, it's only really happened a couple of times. I mean, sometimes I've had, I remember a birth years ago where the baby did restitute, fully restituted, did not come out, just despite maternal effort, and like needed me to pull the baby out. It's just like, I think she just had a really tight pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. It's like it was caught in there.
So navigated the bony pelvis, but did not navigate the soft structures. just for a bit of
young women, you know, with nice, and she was totally intact despite me having to go in and pull it out. Yeah, weird.
Amazing.
As long as they just go pop. Also, I wanted to talk to you about just touching on when the midwives who'd only ever worked in a hospital finally came to watch a woman give birth at home, and how their minds were just totally blown. That, like, you can't describe it to someone, because I've never seen what they've seen. I've never seen women give birth on a bed every time, you know, hooked up and all that stuff. So when they saw the dance, you know, the birth dance, and that they had to do so little, one of the really rewarding things that came out of it was, then they'd say to me, you know, weeks later, now my practice is different in the hospital. I've changed everything, because I can see how much easier it is for the woman if you just stop doing, you know, all the things. Yeah.
It's true. And I think you don't have to see many, one or two. And I know when I've mentored a few midwives into private practice and they see their first home birth, and you look at them, and basically you can see all these new neural pathways developing in their brain, and they're reconsidering their entire previous career in this one little second. And I've said to midwives before, I've completely ruined you now. That's it. You won't be able to be the same midwife that you've been. And I remember taking a student out, because I take students every year from uni.
That is so good. It's the best way for them to learn. Yeah.
And one student, the birth happened, and I said, how was that? She said, I think I just watched midwifery for the first time.
Yeah, not obstetric nursing.
Yeah, I was like, whoa. She said, I think I just watched midwifery and actual birth, and you can't unsee that.
It should be compulsory. And also in obstetric training, they should have to see physiological birth more than once, a few times, to have their mind blown.
And this because is what
they,
doesn't
they happen. Honestly must think that women's bodies are very flawed, because they're only called in when things don't go well.
And the home birth program that you set up through the Royal, is how's it going?
Apparently still good. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, still doing home births. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
I'm very proud of that.
You should be. And I can't wait to hear about it at the conference, because I think a lot of people listening will be thinking, how do we get this going in our own hospitals? And that's what we're going to get into at the convergence.
Well, I've approached the college. When I was in Adelaide last year at the national conference, we had a brief conversation. I guess they're busy. It needs to be like a package that's accessible to any hospital. Yep. Go, this is what you do, because I've got it all there. Because it's not that hard. You just have to have passionate people. And it came about at the women's, because there was some really amazing consumers, one of whom you know very well, who really agitated to, you know, just kept saying, we've got to keep meeting, we've got to keep meeting, and finally it happened. Yeah, it was awesome. I loved it.
Amazing. Yeah. And Cheryl, where to now for you then? What's happening for you?
Look, I'm ready to just be grandma. Like the kids call me Mim. I've got 5 grandchildren. When I finished being on call all those years, you know, I had my last birth, which is grandchild number 5, and finished. She was my last. It was my, it wasn't my daughter. It was my daughter's partner that had the baby. And she was my very last client. And I just felt like I wanted to run away. I just went to Cooktown and worked and been going out to Broken Hill and going away a lot, doing all the things that you can't do when you're on call. All the things except getting drunk. I thought I'd want to get drunk, but I didn't. And I think I was a bit nervous about like going full on into full time grandmothering. But every time I go away now, I miss the kids just too much, the grandbabies, and I'm sort of almost ready for that. Yeah.
Oh, Cheryl, thank you so much for your just years of dedication to midwifery, of learning about physiological birth, and then you've left a legacy of having educated lots of midwives in your time, but now also with this home birth program, making it more accessible to people. And, you know, your work is going to live on through that as well.
I really hope so. Yes,
amazing. And I can't wait to hear more about it at the Convergence and see you at the Convergence. And, yes, amazing.
Thanks so much for asking me, Mel. It was Melanie, it was fantastic. Thank you.
Oh,
I really enjoyed talking to you.
That's been today's episode of The Great Birth Rebellion. We've been with Cheryl Sidery, and we'll see you in the next episode.